ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. This is John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. It's Wednesday, May 17th, that we're recording for publication on Thursday, May 18th. John, what's our theme?
The theme is private equity, pork fest, or criminal syndicates.
Right. So we talked last week about private equity potentially being brought into to dine on the banking system of the United States. So I thought I would pull out some charts and graphs and we'd look a little closer at how private equity is trading and what's going on with private equity. So let's just dive in and start with Crisis Watch.
Yeah, okay, let's do exactly that and start off with Mish, who's got a story on dollar weaponization expands. FDIC message to foreign depositors is don't trust the U.S. This continues a theme that we've picked up earlier, but it just sort of expands on it. He's quoting from a Wall Street Journal article here. The California-based American depositors were protected when the FDIC took control of Silicon Valley Bank on March 10th. It has been, in other words, the FDIC steps in and goes ahead and insures everybody over $250,000. But
right.
Wait, not so fast. It has been a vastly different story for customers of Silicon Valley Bank's Cayman Islands branch. The FDIC made a systemic risk exception to Silicon Valley Bank to protect depositor funds beyond its $250,000 bank account limit. But that insurance is for U.S. depositors only. In other words, the Cayman Islands people are just SOL. They're out of luck. The clear message, says Mish, by the FDIC is don't bank in the U.S. If you do, you better be at one of the giant, too big to fail banks. And he follows up here, if the Fed can confiscate Russia's reserves, which you and I, Catherine, talked about earlier,
right?
Who's next?
Well, when I sent this to one person and they wrote back and said, this is a virtual act of war. So if you look at the numbers right now, if you take Citibank and JP Morgan Chase, they have in combination $1 trillion of foreign deposits, which are uninsured. Mm-hmm. So if you're that $1 trillion, how are you going to feel about this? Now, they've got a $1.5 trillion of domestic deposits.
Right.
But, suddenly every foreign deposit is now staring down the fact that this may, the risk issue of holding federal credit just went up. And it's not, they're not going to assume this just with deposits, John. They're going to be starting to think about Fannies and Freddies and treasuries and all sorts of stuff. Do we have a two-tiered financial system?
Right.
So this is a seismic shift. There's an earthquake going on underneath the markets on this.
Yeah, it goes back to what we've been talking about for months or years on this program, which is your financial system and your monetary system ultimately hinges on the rule of law,
right?
Meaning it's got to be applied equally across the board. You can't just come in willy-nilly and start suspending due process and confiscating assets, on a whim and not expect consequences.
Right. Although the FDIC, as a legal matter, cannot insure foreign deposits. I mean, they would literally have to go to Congress to get that authorization. And the question is, when they transferred the other deposits, could they have transferred these deposits without them being essentially wiped out?
Well, they can do whatever they want because they have the systemic risk exception. In other words, it's just all they have to do, the systemic thing, and this has been true since the bailouts, they wave this wand of systemic.
Right.
They go into a secret room, they close the doors, they kick out the court reporters, and they do whatever they want.
Right.
And it boils down to a matter of luck, not a matter of law or a matter of smarts. And the whole world's watching.
So here's the question. Who really had those deposits? I mean, it was coming in from the Cayman Islands, so that's an Anglo-American alliance. It's a British offshore territory, overseas territory.
Right.
So these are the Anglo-American alliance offshore network. Now, we're told most of them were Chinese, but we, in fact, do not have the facts of who those depositors were and why they're leaving them high and dry.
In my point of view is, does that really matter? But we know that the Chinese depositors were backed up at Silicon Valley Bank in the U.S.
Right.
So it's like, well, what the hell is going on here? Again, it gets back to, we don't know what's going on inside that black box. All we know is that the rules that are out in the open don't apply. They're openly derogated for whatever officials want to do in dark rooms.
Right. So if you're a foreign depositor, because we know JP Morgan Chase has been losing deposits. And one of the questions is this roundup of other banks' deposits happening, because this is how they're, you know, they're going to replenish their deposits.
Yeah.
But on one hand, they're replenishing their deposits. But if you look at how they're doing it, you know, it's going to spook a lot of people in the global markets.
Yeah, right, right. You mentioned deposits in large banks. I want to cut to a graph from the FDIC to show people what you're talking about.
Okay.
So let's take a look at this. This is from the FRED website, Federal Reserve Economic Database. The blue line is large domestically chartered banks. You can see that up there at the top in the legend, meaning it's up here. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the blue is large domestically chartered banks. And this is the red line is small domestically chartered banks, meaning basically everybody else. And I've added a constant to the red line so it proves the scale. Otherwise, the red line's way down at the bottom and you can't see. But the relative movement is what you want to look at here. So this is the gray line is the pandemic, the gray bar there. And so you can see here that during after the pandemic, deposits went up like this for the big banks, and they went up a little bit less for the small banks, which is what you would expect because basically the big banks have twice as many deposits as small banks. But look at this. This is what you're talking about. The big banks starting in 2022, in the spring of 2022, really suffered major deposit losses.
Right.
But the small banks were fine.
Right.
Small banks are A-okay, no problem. But then you come to the banking crisis, and look what happens. The media is like, hey, the small banks are the problem. The small banks are, it's a regional banking crisis. That scares people out of the small banks for a week, and then they just keep on trucking again, right?
Right.
And the big banks, they continued on their pattern because everybody thought, well, that's not really the problem. Actually, we now know the banks that have failed are all huge. They're all in the top 30 banks in the U.S. out of 4,700.
Right. But what I see is the large banks trying to take advantage of this. In other words, part of what we're looking at is a roundup, and the big banks are trying to compete back by playing dirty.
They're shooting dirty pool.
Right.
Yep. And they're using the media to do it.
Yes.
The media is carrying the water of the big banks saying, oh, big banks safe, small banks, mid-sized banks are the problem. The graph tells the story. The American people know what they're doing.
I have to bring up a non sequitur because somebody sent me yesterday an excerpt from the Durham report.
Yeah.
And essentially, we now have an official Department of Justice report saying the FBI never had any evidence of any Russian collusion, none, zero, zippo, which means the media for 4 years ran a hoax and they knew it.
Yeah.
So the Department of Justice knew it was a hoax. The media knew it was a hoax. And I think the time, you know, we've reached the time where people are now beginning to realize, you know, they really would perpetuate a hoax for 4 years.
Absolutely, they would. And I was going to suggest that we, you know, the Durham report merits a lot more attention. We're not going to really touch on it,
right?
You know, today, really get into it. That really warrants a lot of attention because, again, it gets back to there's no rule of law.
Right.
There's absolutely no rule of law. It's just rule by committee, rule by whoever happens to be in power,
right,
doing whatever they want. There's no standards. There's no laws. There's just tyranny. And that's where we're headed. And that's what that Durham report speaks to. We should touch on that in 2 weeks, big time.
We will.
Yeah,
we will. It needs first. You need it to be publicized and you know shake around, and then we can talk about it. But what you're, you know, it's part and parcel. If you look at what Yellen has done so far, or the Fed has done so far in terms of, because I don't consider it a banking crisis. I consider it a banking roll up. And but if you look at what they're doing in the marketplaces, you combine that with the sanctions, and now, you know, Durham basically showing that the Department of Justice will run a four-year hoax along with the media. There's not a Treasury holder or a foreign deposit holder who's not staring down a complete repricing of their risk.
Yeah, I would tell people, listen, if you're watching television now, if you continue to watch TV news after this, you're an addict. I can't help you when you're just addicted to television, because that's right. what it is. That's just an addiction at that point. When you right. are openly being fed misinformation, nothing but misinformation for 4 straight years, just stop watching. Just unplug the damn thing.
Well, misinformation that's harming you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just, you know, there's misinformation which is entertaining and does no harm.
Right.
But there's also misinformation that's basically stealing your money.
We just saw it in the graph where you right. see the big banks are the ones that are in trouble, and the media saying, get into the big banks, they're safe. Stay out of the little banks, they're dangerous, when it's right. 180 degrees the other way around.
Right. It's a steal.
It's a total, they're totally vectoring you in the exact opposite direction of where you want to be.
Yeah. They're reversing the news to get you to bank with their advertisers.
Yep. You got it.
Yep.
It's really scary what's going on. The DOJ and the FBI, because that's law enforcement, is you know, the overtones and the echoes from Germany in the 40s. I'm sorry, they can't be ignored now.
So it's really funny because I remember we had this great tax attorney working for us, helping us with the sort of bankruptcy issues. We never filed for bankruptcy, but we wanted to stay out of bankruptcy. So I hired this guy who was an expert, and he went over to our offices while the Department of Justice and FBI had seized them. You know, and I've told you how lawless and crazy the whole thing was. And he came over to meet me at another law firm, and he was shaking like a leaf. I'll never forget. His whole body was shaking. And he said, my family left Germany to get away from these people, and now we're here. How are they, you know, what are yeah. we going to do? Now that, John, was in 1998.
Right. Okay. Right, 25 years ago.
Is 97 or 98?
Yeah.
And I remember every year watching the Department of Justice break the law and break the law and break the law and break the law. And Carolyn Betts saying to me, how can they do this? And I said, don't worry. It's just a matter of time until everybody, you know, because it spreads like an infection.
Yeah. Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, you know, 100 years ago said, you know, when you have the lawmakers openly breaking the law, it's a matter of time before you invite and get on your hands open anarchy.
Right.
That's kind of what
got him to say that?
I don't remember, but I believe it had something to do with he was writing at the time about the separation of banking and commerce.
Uh-huh.
And why they needed to be kept separate. But I may be conflating things. That's what he said. He says law breaking out the opens. That's
Steiner
a recipe
says
for big time
that,
trouble.
That in the threefold social order, that the justice aspect of society must completely be independent and protected from the economy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
Exactly.
And Obama's administration did wonders for just ripping that separation down and right. saying, oh, no, it's systemic considerations first, justice second. We can't prosecute you because you're economically important. And that right. went away as official policy under Obama. And that's when I started ringing the bell, like, this ain't going to end well. Trust
no.
me.
Well, that gets us to the FDIC report. So let's keep
yeah,
going.
Let's keep going. Okay. FDIC releases comprehensive overview of deposit insurance system. So they're saying, okay, well, we're going to go one of three ways. We can either go limited coverage, which is what we have now, up to $250,000. We can go unlimited coverage. In other words, everything is insured in the bank, or targeted coverage. And this is a slippery slope here, offering different deposit insurance limit across account types, where, for example, business payment accounts receive significantly higher coverage than other accounts. This is a slippery slope because they're just saying, well, depending on who you are, we can change your status. And
right.
that's your social credit system.
Right.
If you're woke, so, you have higher limits. And if you're not woke, you have lower limits. That's
right.
What
there are all sorts of games on who's on the inside and who's on the outside and who gets to have, you know, this is an unbelievably slippery slope. If I were them, I wouldn't open this door because once you go there, it's impossible.
They've already opened it, Catherine, to my way of thinking, with a systemic risk society, which meets enclosed behind
right.
closed doors with no transparency and decides
right.
whatever they want to do.
Right.
This is just kind of formalizing it. Like, hey, there's more of the same. aren't you lucky?
Right. But they, I don't but know. They, in theory, you could say any business has it as a, and you could work off what their payroll was, you know, to protect their basic. If you're looking at their basic throughput for their, you know, payroll, you could do it as a percent of payroll, but it would have to be all enterprises, all businesses, all enterprises, everybody. That's, you know, but right. It's a slippery slope.
I'm sure that would be equally enforced. It's very so confident. Anyway, let's change gears to FedWatch and the debt limit debate going on right now. This is from Washington Post. Liberals, that's kind of a weird headline coming from the Post. Liberals grow fearful that Biden may reward GOP for weaponizing debt ceiling. So they're trying to paint this debt ceiling instead of saying, hey, you know, why are we borrowing our money into existence? They're trying to politicize it. And so here's the battle lines. Biden aides have been in talks with staffers representing leaders in Congress about a deal to fund the federal government next year that would also raise the nation's debt ceiling. The fresh talks, and here's the rub, follow months in which Biden and his top aides insisted that the White House would not entertain making any trade-offs to raise the debt limit, saying that would set a dangerous precedent that encouraged GOP brinkmanship. And yet, to some critics, the administration appears to be doing exactly that, following unrelenting pressure from the business community and even some moderate Democratic voices to enter bipartisan talks after the House passed a spending and debt limit bill last month. Biden administrations are adamant that they are working with House Republicans on a deal only to fund the government in the next fiscal year, not to raise the debt ceiling. Okay? So that's how they're spinning this whole thing. And I love this quote here at the end. A key part of this is whether the White House will be able to credibly say the elements that get negotiated are ones that would have been on the table this year anyway. So they're totally trying to spin this debate as left versus right. And you and I know that's...
So the funny thing is the debt ceiling is a totally contrived political...
Yeah.
In other words, essentially, if your entire federal credit mechanism has the power to print dollars ad nauseum, it's impossible to default unless you decide you want to, as a political matter.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So there's no crisis here except, you know, the crisis that the politicians decide to have. Not to say that they don't have serious disagreements, especially over, you know, the pork fest that Washington has put out both sides of the House for the last 20 or 30 years. The big news, though, is our interest payments just passed defense spending. So we are now, you know, as of this week, we are now spending as much on the interest on the public debt as we are on our entire defense spending, which, of course, raises the question, why do we have a debt-based currency system?
Right.
And why is $21 trillion missing from the federal government and nobody trying to get it back?
Right. The other thing, you know, I've thought about this week with the $21 trillion is how much money do you imagine would be missing in a non-debt-based monetary system? You know, something to think about. I don't know the answer to it.
You know, you could be missing as much money. Now, you know, it's funny because I was talking to Skidmore about this, and he was right when he said, well, you couldn't do it without a debt-based monetary system because the inflation would hit them immediately faster and they'd notice that the money was disappearing.
He's got a point.
What he's saying is a manufactured bubble allows a lot more stealing before people feel it.
It sure does. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, and I always said the reason, if you look at the Asian philosophy of military engagement versus the Western, I always said it was because the West invented the bond market so they could have the war before the taxes hit the peasants. You know, whereas the Asians had no bond market, so they had to tax the peasants on a pay-as-you-go basis. And that meant for a much more cost-effective strategy.
You are on very solid historical footing there, Ms. Fitz. Very
that's
solid.
The difference. That's the difference between Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz.
Yeah, that's very solid footing there. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, anyway. Let's turn, on again in FedWatch, another story. We've praised DeSantis a lot in this program.
We're about to reverse that.
But you know, he doesn't walk on water. And the next story.
Tell me about it.
Cuts to that. And we've skipped a couple weeks in a row where they got near to making a cut. They didn't quite make the cut about DeSantis doing this or that. But this week, we get to a guy.
You know,
who really
I get a lot of subscribers complaining that he does a great job, you know, on these things like, you know, outlawing CBDC. But then beneath the carpet, he's passing all these dirty tricks.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, DeSantis
is a trickster.
Right. And this next story is one person's point of view on exactly that. He's a trickster. Here you go. From The Last Refuge. The writer here is Sundance, who I think you and I both talked to. Pretty good writer. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis always makes a big deal about signing all of Florida laws from his office out in the open. However, when he signed the new law that sealed all of his travel records, he did so very quietly. The not pretending reason for the exclusive DeSantis new law is to stop anyone from tracing the background of his travel and the billionaire special interests and donors who funded it as he launches his 2024 presidential campaign. DeSantis 24 is 100% guaranteed to be an absolute construct of the billionaires, multinationals, and hedge fund managers who must stop Donald Trump and the America First platform. And here you go. Here he concludes with this whopper or showstopper. Ron DeSantis is the counterfeit $100 bill on a fishing line that was dragged through the MAGA hood by professional Republican politicians who need to stop the takeover of the party. And that's the read on DeSantis. He's a billionaire boy. That's why he's there.
I don't know. You know, the Republican offering is not looking very good.
No, we're done. No.
Nope.
They're not leaving us many options.
You know, we have a choice between the wonderful guy who brought you Operation Warp Speed and this guy who's flying to Israel to sign laws.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
He brought you Operation Warp Speed. He brought you Goldman Sachs into the Treasury. Well.
Yep.
Or Mr. Israel, like you point out.
Right.
Mr. Secrecy.
Right.
Well, that's not. I don't know. I can think of analogies, but they're not pleasant. Anyway, let's keep it going and turn to Argentina in FedWatch, because this story is germane to what's going on with interest rates. Argentina plans new rate hike, more foreign exchange intervention as inflation soars. How bad is the problem in Argentina? Argentina's government announced a package of measures to rein in soaring inflation and support the wobbly peso currency. The Ministry of the Economy did not elaborate, but an official source told Reuters the hike would be 600 basis points, bringing the rate up to 97%. But here you go, the inevitable International Monetary Fund. You think the country might learn from its mistakes? Nope, here you go. Here's the chainsaw and the flannel shirt. An agreement with the International Monetary Fund to dole out funds to the cash-strapped nation will be sped up as well, the ministry added. They never learn.
No.
Stop
no.
borrowing money from foreign countries and foreign currencies.
Right.
I don't get it.
It's a steal.
It's a steal. It's worse than that. It's a good way to lose your sovereignty.
Right. Oh, I think Argentina lost it. You know, the first round of disaster capitalism in the late 90s was very, very devastating. And if you watch the documentaries of what happened, you know, you're basically talking about a company that's being progressively harvested by vulture capitalists.
Yeah, a country. It's
right.
It's looked at as a country.
Right.
As a company, but it's...
Well, the problem is when they do it, they destroy a lot of productive enterprises. And Naomi Klein's husband, who's a documentary, did a wonderful documentary about a factory that was shut down, and the workers just went in and got it going again. And the owners were trying to stop them, but they were just trying to produce productive, you know, a productive business.
Yeah. It's not good. I mean, the country can do fine on its own, but the vultures, like you say, coming from the outside. Perkins, John Perkins, has made a cottage industry out of that.
Right. So in these situations, what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to do barter. You want to be able to do time trading systems. You want to be able to do local currencies. What you've got to do is you got to move out of the, you know, whatever the majority currency is and start operating, you know, person to person, asset to asset, time to time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like prison. You got to use cigarettes.
Right. There's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing.
There's nothing wrong with using your own currency, but a lot wrong with borrowing currency that can be printed by someone else who may not have your interest at heart.
But here's the little secret to building those systems to barter or to trade local currency. All those systems operate on relationships. And you can't wait until you're in the emergency to create those relationships. That's one of the reasons I keep telling people, go out and start talking to local business, start using cash back and forth. Because once you're using cash and you've got that relationship and you're really working together, if you need to switch to a local currency or trade time or anything else, you know, when the day comes, you can do it.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's too late when the rug gets pulled.
Right.
Yeah. That's a great point. Okay, let's start creeping into private equity, but we're gonna get there in a non-obvious way, and that's through immigration.
Okay.
So I've got a video. There's a video on YouTube. There's a video on YouTube that shows immigration patterns, and it's 5 minutes long and it has a really annoying music track to it. So what I've done, I've sped it up so it's a minute.
Great.
Yeah, so it's a minute long.
Yeah, I sent it to you.
Yeah, you sent it to me. So let me just cut over to it so you can see it here. And it's so the thing to keep on, you look down here, that's the year. It's going to start like a ticker, start counting away going into 2020. And then this is the total number of people in the country. And these are the country in the U.S. And these are the countries that they're coming from. So they start off in 1820, you know, these were African countries. That's the slave trade. Right. But eventually European countries are going to move up and eventually Mexico is going to move up. I want you to watch as we move. I'll get this video started. Watch. There's an inflection point in 1972 that's not to be believed. Watch this. You can hear a little bit of the music. So Germany and Ireland right up immediately.
All those Texas farmers coming from Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. You got it. So a lot of Europeans right now have taken over 1800s, late 1800s. So very, very white, you know?
Yeah, very European.
Yeah, very European for a long time. And then after the war.
So Italy takes over.
Yeah, and then we get into the 60s. And then 70, watch this. Look at this.
Yep, it's an explosion from Mexico.
Starts in 72.
Yep.
And look how far it's outpacing the others. And it's burying the others.
Yep.
So that's that. That's the sort of, I would say, a softer video, but it does a very effective job of illustrating the dominance of Mexico in immigration after 1972. What happened in was that the gold standard? What did that?
I don't know, but clearly there was a decision to flood the country.
Yeah. Yep. And there's no doubt
and
about
it. It came very much contiguous with a huge jump up in narcotics trafficking.
Yeah.
So
that's a great point.
If you look at the whole, you know, you sort of built the train tracks in the 70s and then you got the crack cocaine explosion in the 80s and it just, and then the MS-16 and cartel from there.
Yeah. MS-13, I think it is.
I'm sorry. MS-13. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a link in the link in the show notes to that video where you can watch it in more depth.
Well, the other thing I love about that video is it shows you how important and powerful immigration has been to building America.
Yeah.
It's been very significant.
Right. And you could see that in that video, what's going on in different eras.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very effective at doing that. And you can't see that from the next story, but it's an immigration story. Statistics. Let's take a look at this. And there's just one thing to know about this. Migrant stock is the number of people born in a country other than that in which they live. So in the U.S., migrants are people who were born in the U.S. So here are the numbers they put out, and they seem kind of innocuous. So immigration statistics for 2015 was you had a 5.53% increase to 46.6 million people from 2010, 5.53% increase. That may not seem like a lot, 5.53%, but if you think the U.S. population itself only moves 0.38% in a year, 0.4%, 5.53% in 5 years is a big deal, right?
Right.
And so these are the basic numbers and they put it in five-year blocks. I don't know why they do that, but the number now is 46.6%, and that's almost, the population is 332 million, so it's almost 15%. But look at the graphs here. They're interesting. The migrant population, okay, back to 1960, you could see it was 10 million. Now it's 46.6 million. It really gets going kind of in the 90s, but you can really see it here. Percentage of total population, like I said, now it's 14.5%. In 1990, it was 9%. But right. it really got going in the 90s. And again, like you said, that's someone's making that decision to do that. You know, and then they've got all the numbers here compared to other countries. U.S. has 46.6 million. There's our number again. And in other populations, it's a lot less than that, but their populations are a lot less. Anyway, those are some interesting numbers.
Right. And so remember, it's 15% overall. But if you look at the states where the heavy concentration of immigration is, it's a much higher number. You know, particularly, you know, county by county, you have counties, you know, just like you have cities in Germany, which are being overwhelmed. And you cannot maintain a cohesive society because it's changing too rapidly. And it's changing too rapidly with people who don't know the culture or don't speak the language. And so you've got a real digestion problem that is interfering again with productivity.
Yes. Okay, so that's kind of the immigration, the numbers part of it. And the numbers are important because they show you the timing of it. It really got going in 72, and it really got a big boost in the 90s. Big boost during the Clinton administration. You notice
right.
that?
Right.
Okay.
But what's incredible to me about the immigration story is if you look at what's happening over the last year, it's just exploding. And we see literally Kennedy... I don't know if you saw Kennedy's latest interview where he discusses the borders, but he sounds stronger than Trump or more conservative than Trump on closing the borders.
Wow.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's interesting you say that in light of the stories we're going to cover next, because Kennedy is a wealthy, you know, he comes from a lot of wealth.
Right.
If anybody knows the ins and outs of private equity, he's probably still a member of the Kennedy family.
Right.
Knows what those guys are capable of. Let's look at these next two stories. First one from the New York Post, shocking photos. By the way, this story is May 10th. I'll come back to that. Shocking photos show kids as young as 13 hired by Blackstone firm to clean slaughterhouse. Disturbing photos show kids, some possibly as young as 13, being put to work in a Nebraska slaughterhouse after being hired by a cleaning company owned by billionaire Stephen Schwartzman's buyout firm, Blackstone. A Labor Department probe has revealed. The company here is called PSSI. It's Packer Sanitation Services, Inc. The Labor Department launched this investigation into the company last August after a 14-year-old girl at Walnut Middle School in Grand Island came to school with acid burns on her hands and knees. We'll see why that is in a minute. The ensuing probe found the company hired 102 children between the ages of 13 and 17 among PSSI's thousands of workers at 13 meatpacking plants in 8 different states. But let's talk about those acid burns on our hands and knees. What are these kids doing? When did this cut down to the bad part of this? Oh, but PSSI and Blackstone both claim on 60 Minutes. They have no idea that they employ children in 8 states. They had no idea. They just had no idea this was going on. They were shocked at the gambling in the casino.
If you look at all the work it takes to bring all those immigrants across the border and get them up to Nebraska to do this.
Yeah.
You know, that takes a lot of intentional work and planning and logistics.
Yeah. I want to find. Give me a second. Anyway, maybe it's in the, it might be in the next story. That's a New York Post story. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that was May. That story, though, was based on an earlier story from March. This is an in-depth look by a publication called The Lever. I don't know it. Workers are funding private equity's child labor exploitation. Okay. Here's the same company. So the New York Post is definitely tracking the story. PSSI has been repeatedly bought and sold by private equity firms that manage retirement money for state and local public employees, according to a Lever review. In other words, public officials have been using the retirement savings of unionized teachers, firefighters, and police officers to capitalize and help Wall Street executives profit from an outsourcing business that has used low-paid immigrants and even children for hazardous work in slaughterhouses. Private equity firms have loaded packers up with debt in order to pay themselves big dividends. The company's current owner is the world's largest private equity firm, the Blackstone Group, whose Republican mega donor CEO collected, get this, $1.3 billion in pay and dividends last year. Okay? They talk about, though, what the kids are doing. Here you go. Here's where the acid burns came from. Just a different story. Children as young as 13 using dangerous chemicals to clean back saws, head splitters, fat skinners, and blood-soaked floors. NBC News reported that the kids were largely undocumented migrants. Head splitters. You know why they did it? For cows,
yeah,
whose skulls or something.
Right.
And they got to clean that equipment with really dangerous chemicals. That's where those burns came from.
Right.
That's nauseating.
Right. And I forget which story it is, describes teachers complaining because the kids keep falling asleep during school.
Yeah.
Because they're up all night working and then they come to school. Right.
Yeah. So that's really, in other words, don't think that, you know, immigration is just some, people are making money big time off immigration, and private equity is one of them.
Well, but I really believe a lot of the private equity game has been to make money in, I would describe it as vulture capitalism. So I saw it on the private prisons in a way that they can keep secret. So they produce the returns for the pension funds or the investors. But, you know, if you look at how they're really making the money, it's just like when KKR took over RJR Nabisco. If you read my online book, I describe the extent to which that's a narcotics trafficking and money laundering game.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big part of it. Private equity is nasty. I mean, those kids that they're being abused, and those borders are open for a reason. And the reason is people are making money off of it.
Okay, so now I'm going to be really dark. Okay, hold on. If they can get digital IDs and CBDCs, that's going to be your kids.
Yeah. Right.
Don't think that's poor Mexican kids. You know, it's going to be all the kids.
Yeah, you think $1.3 billion, Mr. $1.3 billion, Schwartzman is thinking, oh, I would only do this to Mexican kids.
Right.
I would never, ever, ever do that to a white kid from Walnut Creek, California. Oh, no.
Right. And that's why,
don't,
you know, we're
yourself
in this issue of, is there law or no law? Because if there's no law for that Mexican kid, if they get to the point where they have that kind of control, there's going to be no law for us.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
If there's no rule of law, it means the laws don't protect you when you need them the most. That's what that means. Now, we're going to get to some private equity charts later, but I do want to cut to a private equity infographic that you sent that I had to look at it twice to really see, like, oh, wow, this is a pretty amazing chart. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Okay, let's look at this. I think this is a great chart. So here it is. Here's a view from 40,000 feet. I'm going to zoom in, though. How big is private equity? Okay, let's take a look here. So the number one firm here, you can see, is the Blackstone Group, $95.9 billion. Okay, it ranks at number one. They've got it sort of laid out here like a roulette wheel. So mm-hmm. Blackstone, one, Carlyle, two, KKR, three, TPG, Warburg Pincus is five. That's Tim Geithner's outfit. But the thing that got me, Catherine, about this was like, they have the list of companies. You mentioned RJR
right.
In connection with private equity. These private equity firms have all these companies, and there's a lot of names you recognize here. Zoom Info is one. Epic Games, I know that one. UFC, I know that one. McAfee and J. Crew. These are household names.
Right.
Okay. So those are the big five right there. But let's zip down to a favorite on this program. Blackstone. Okay. Here's Blackstone or BlackRock at 17. Okay.
Now that's because their private equity business is relatively small. If you look at the
yes.
they're managing $8 trillion of assets as an asset manager. So their private equity their private equity division, so to speak, is a relatively small part of their business.
Yeah. You see the companies, a lot of these, you know, you and I have had this conversation a few times before we go over the show. Like I'll mention, who is paying for these businesses that keep getting turned over and going out of business?
Right.
Right. And a lot of the names that have kind of come up in our discussions, I then see on this chart.
Right.
Like, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
That's why I'm telling you, there's a huge vulture capitalist game.
Big time.
Big time.
Big time. Yeah.
And we're financing it.
Yeah. We're financing it. You got it. Anyway, take your time. You know, again, we have the link in the show notes. That chart is just great. I think the chart is wonderful. I just am showing you.
Well, you one know, of the reasons I wanted you to see it is, you know, I did charts for the largest four. So it's Blackstone, it's yeah. Carlyle, it's KKR, it's TPG,
yeah,
the old Texas Partnership. Yeah.
Yeah. So, those are interesting charts.
Four. Right.
Yeah. Those are interesting charts. You show them from different time periods, which I found kind of humorous to see who did the jockeying. Anyway, let's turn our attention though now to war in the Ukraine, where things are not going well for NATO at all. And I want to show you this video. This is from The Sun. I got this video and I'll tell you, I recut it again. I shortened it, but also rearranged it. They show the kind of the classic way to do a video is you show your wide shot, your establishing shot, like your context shot, and then you show your narrow shot. The Sun had it another way around. They show the individual shot and the wide shot. I've got it here.
Now, I just want to point out before you start this, right yeah. before this became available, the UK transferred a whole stockpile of missiles to the Ukraine, right?
Yes, in preparation for the counteroffensive, you know, that's been much discussed.
Been promised for a long time, right?
Been much, very much hyped in the media.
Right.
You're right. There was a massive transfer of a stockpile of weapons to the Ukraine. And now we go to this video. I'll point out that there's a big black cloud. So there's already been an explosion here. Before we've seen this, and you can see the fire down here. There's no audio with this part of the video, but then all of a sudden the audio cuts in when we cut to the close-up video that the guy right. takes with the cell phone. And
right.
to prepare viewers for that, I've overlaid onto the wide shot video we're going to see here a 3-2-1 countdown in red, so you can kind of get ready for it. But let's watch
okay.
this. Okay, here we go. There's the explosion. This is from a rooftop. You can see, looks like it's on a tripod, but it's so bright it colors the color, it changes the color temperature of the camera. Camera adjusts.
Wow, look at that!
Yeah, and that's at least explosion number two. Okay, that's a major plume. Okay, now we're getting ready to go to the local video. That's what it looked like up close. Look at that monster. It's like lava in the center of that.
Why do I have a feeling they let the missiles be deposited in one place?
I don't know, but that's something else. And I want to point out, you can check that video in the show notes. There's a link to it. But if you go, the link is to a YouTube video by The Sun. I want to point out what the Sun's caption was for the video, okay? The caption was, this will give you a flavor for the propaganda going on. Horrific new video highlight a desperate bid by Putin to destroy Ukrainian ammunition before Zelensky orders his expected counteroffensive. So that, the reason for that explosion is Putin's desperate. He's so desperate, he blew up all our weapons. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's scary.
So ridiculous. He's so desperate, he just destroyed all our weapons. That just shows how desperate he is, that he would resort to destroying all of our weapons in one fell swoop. And that, by the way, that explosion, that was a day or two before we saw even more recent videos, which we're not showing, of Patriot missile systems firing off like 30 times in a row.
Right.
Then there's a pause as the Russian hypersonic missiles zero in on where those Patriot systems are and then annihilates them off the face of the earth.
Right.
It's not going well.
This is not going well at all.
Now, that said, it is war, and all bets are off.
Right.
You get into a war, you get into a fight, you don't know. Lady Fortuna can be very powerful in these things. So,
yep.
But right now, it ain't going well for NATO. Let's tell you that. Okay. Okay, you ready to turn to Hey Robot? This is...
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to jump over space, military, global turf wars. Nothing there this week.
Yeah,
this week.
Nothing really there.
Right.
Okay, so let's go to Hey Robot with this. This is terrible. 3D printed fish set to hit the market. I thought you'd lost your mind. You saw me the story. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? Of course it's an Israeli company, has created a method of 3D bioprinting your very own fresh fish, which it says, will be ready for cooking immediately. How disgusting. Stakeholder Foods has developed a 3D printed grouper fish. That's my favorite fish, you bastards. From stem cells, which are then processed via bioprinting technology into fish-like shape. The product, which is created in conjunction with Umami Meats, mimics the taste and texture of natural fish, and it could be on supermarket shelves later this year. I think it's umami. Like,
know your farmer and know your fisherman. I'm telling you, you can't be too careful about your food. I'll never forget the one time I published a story about the Chinese filling out the shrimp with plastic to puff them up and make them look bigger. Can you imagine? But so this is in 2012. I was managing money, and you know, I had a partnership in California managing money, and we're looking at a company in San Diego that was figuring out how to use stem cells to build livers for transplant, kidneys and livers. And I came home, and I was staying with Cord Skinner and his wife, and Cord has a PhD from MIT, used to be head of research at National Semiconductor, and I'm telling him about this, and he doesn't believe me, thought I was making it up. And he just then turns on the TV to watch. He and his wife were watching Breaking Bad, and there was a science program before, and they were in a fictional story about science. They have a 3D printer that's making organs for transplant. And he looked at me and said, "Oh God, it's true. Oh no."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, that's a great story.
Yeah.
It's a great story. But plastic to puff up fish, you say?
No, shrimp. They were jumbo shrimp, and they were injecting it with liquid plastic to puff them up and make them look bigger for sale.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Speaking of...
Know your farmer.
speaking of plastic, let's go to the next story from Defender with the inevitable Bill Gates Gates-funded edible food coating gets green light from regulators. Appeal Sciences, a U.S.-based company that's partnered with the Gates Foundation to develop a new product, Edipeel, an edible coating for fruit and vegetables to solve the supposed food wastage crisis. Food waste is a supermarket's exacting standards, searing masses of vegetables and fruit left to rot before they even leave the fields because it's not pretty enough or straight enough. UK supermarket chains Tesco and Asda are already trialing the product along with avocado producers to extend the shelf life of the fresh produce. So basically, they're going to coat this, they're going to coat your food with this edible plastic, more or less, made by the Gates Foundation.
Yeah, if we're lucky. If we're not lucky, it'll be a vaccine.
Yeah, and the story points out, you know, you don't really have a choice in it. You know, if it's in the supermarket, it's not like you can go, well, I don't want the one with the plastic coating.
Right. No you labeling.
Know, there's no labeling. They're all gonna come.
I'm telling you, grow your own or know your farmer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that bad.
Yep. Yep.
So as soon as Amazon bought Whole Food, that was when I left Whole Food because you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't tell from looking at the package that it really was a chicken, you don't know it's chicken.
Right. Right.
I'm a suspicious woman.
Yeah. I mean, what is Amazon doing with Whole Foods? That was never made sense. Nothing worked there. Like Amazon had a strict, you know, non-drug policy. I know Whole Foods didn't. I mean, every cashier there is pretty much I can't speak for all Whole Foods. A lot of pot smoking going on among cashiers at Whole Foods. And you were going to strict anti-drug company? And nothing, the whole thing, the Amazon Whole Foods thing, doesn't make sense.
Right.
Doesn't make, like, what is up? Anyway. Okay, let's switch to Farmageddon. And, you know, I've said a long time with this story about the military being at the top of the food chain.
Right.
You know, what's the one paragraph summary of that? And I've yet to see it. Now I see it, though. With Robert Kennedy stepping in. And this is from our man Skidmore, Lighthouse Economics. Kennedy did an interview and he details how the NSA was in charge of Operation Warp Speed's COVID-19 mRNA vaccine, among other things. And this is a quote. This whole thing here is a quote from Kennedy during this interview. He says, when Warp Speed turned over the organizational charts that were classified at the time, it shocked everybody. Because it wasn't the HHS, the CDC, NIH, FDA, or a public health agency. It was the NSA, a spy agency that was at the top and led Operation Warp Speed.
Yeah.
The vaccines were developed, okay? Developed not by Moderna and Pfizer. They were developed by NIH, their own patents are owned 50% by NIH, nor were they manufactured by Pfizer or Moderna. So they weren't developed by Moderna Pfizer, they weren't manufactured by Moderna Pfizer. They were manufactured by military contractors. And basically, here's the punchline. Pfizer and Moderna were paid to put their stamps on those vaccines as if they came from the pharmaceutical industry.
But they didn't.
I just think Kennedy's summary of that is he just cuts right to it. That's the conflict. Right. They're used as a stamp.
This was a military operation, and one of the things we know from the Brooke Jackson case is that under the military contracts and the whole process, all you needed, these were technically, as a legal matter, countermeasures, and all you needed was for them to be approved by the FDA, and the FDA could approve them without them meeting any of the required criteria. They didn't have to comply with the law. Any of the law regulations at the FDA. So as long as the FDA said okay in complete defiance of all their laws and regulations, which was okay,
right,
then they were accepted as a contractual matter and could go forward. And all of the trials that they did were just to show they had no legal meaning.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Because these were countermeasures, they weren't pharmaceuticals.
To me, just at a basic level of understanding, like what's going on in the world, a lot of times it comes down to storytelling. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the litigator, knows how to tell a story. Right. That advances the ball. That helps me understand, like, oh, they put their stamp on it. Now I get it.
Right. Well, right. He has followed, if you watch over the last 2 years, especially as he did the Anthony Fauci book, he has followed all the different contractual and legal relationships throughout the, you know, and they've been in the courts litigating. And as they litigate, they and others like Aaron Seary get documentation. And they've been able to dig out, you know, there's a group of about 20 different groups or people who've been able to dig out, you know, contractually and legally, what's really going on. It's a military operation. It's military intelligence operation. And it's interesting. I sent it to you. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet. There was just a article, I think republished from the National Review and MSN.com, about Kennedy. And the author is talking about how the criticism of Kennedy is unfair. And he goes into his Anthony Fauci book and basically says, look, this thing is totally fact-checked. It's absolutely impeccable. It's dead on. He nails them. And what you're finally beginning to see is you know, years and years and years of hard work as a litigator and an author and a whole network of lawyers and doctors. Basically, ultimately, facts matter, and it's punching through.
Yeah.
And we've just begun. The election is, you know, a year and a half away, and this authenticity and facts are on a roll here.
They are, but the other thing on a roll with this is storytelling.
Right.
That you, I don't care how good your facts are, if you're not able to tell the story, you know, you're not going to get very far. Right. That's how stories have been around. Stories and jury trials were invented at the same time by the same people 3,000 years ago, the Greeks. Right. Not accidental.
Well, here's the thing. The Russell Brand interview, I'm not sure this one was the Russell Brand. It might have been. But the Russell Brand interview of Kennedy, which happened last week, is 30 minutes of great storytelling, including about his dad and uncle and, you know, sort of what was going on with the CIA and the military and all the sort of games over the war game. And it was absolutely fascinating. And it's rocketing all over the internet.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I haven't seen it. I know that it happened because I saw a thumbnail, but I haven't seen it.
Well, it's fun because Russell Brand is so much fun, and the two of them together. Yeah, it's very.
I can imagine.
It's very fun, and there's some real insights that take your breath away.
Yeah,
quite an education.
You have to check it out. For storytelling, like you can never be good enough at telling stories. Anyway, speaking of storytelling, the next story is along the same lines. It's like, okay, now I kind of get it, and that concerns the WHO and what's going on with these amendments and stuff. Here's a story again from the Defender, Kennedy's outfit. Is WHO a front organization for the takeover of the U.S. government? I should just stop right there. I was like, okay, that's what's going on. Is the WHO a front for the takeover of the U.S. government? Of course it is. How simple can it be? The WHO will convene May 21st through the 30th in Geneva, Switzerland, to discuss the proposed pandemic treaty and amendments to the international health regulations. Many analysts have warned that the ratification of either or both of these instruments would diminish or completely strip away sovereignty from nation states and place public health decision-making power in the hands of the WHO and its director general. Francis Boyle, who we've talked about on this program before, professor of international law at University of Illinois, who's drafted some legislation before, agreed. He described the WHO's proposed instruments as an attempt to take over the United States of America by using the WHO as a front for that purpose. Boyle said, there's been so much opposition to the dictates coming out of Washington over the handling of the pandemic that these elites have decided to go to the WHO and use the WHO as a front organization to accomplish its objectives. Again, great storytelling.
Right.
They ran into a problem with the pandemic. The people see through it. Let's go this way. That's how we'll take over.
Right. So I'm in Switzerland today. And the reason I came to Switzerland is we are doing a press conference contiguous with their meeting. So we'll live stream it this Friday on UK Column at CHDTV. And we have an all-star panel of people outing the WHO. It's called, are you ready for the title?
Yeah, what?
Who do you think you are?
That's dynamite. I love that.
Yeah. So we're going to be streaming it. It'll be, let's see, we'll start at 8 p.m. Central, so that's 2 p.m. Eastern. So it'll be on CHD TV and UK Column and CHD Europe. And of course, we'll, you know, after we live stream, we'll have the videos up. So check it
out. Great.
Yeah, it's a fabulous bunch. It's all the, you know, it's all the people who've been fighting the WHO all the way along, and they've got the story. They do have the story.
That's great. Yeah. Okay, Farmageddon, let's keep it going. This next one, you know, more of the same. Large study finds people who receive COVID jab have higher risk of visual impairment. A new cohort study revealed that people who received the COVID-19 injections were up to 3.5 times more likely to suffer from visual impairment than the unvaccinated. This is published in Nature, which said the study says overall the risk of retinal vascular occlusion in the vaccinated cohort was significantly higher than in unvaccinated. One common type of retinal vascular occlusion is retinal vein occlusion, RVO, where the flow of blood from the retina blood vessels inside the eye to the heart is blocked, often because a blood clot is blocking the retinal vein, a blood clot. So once again, we learned that the vaccination is a clot shot, not really a vaccination.
Right.
Now it's showing up in people's eyes.
We've had several presentations at the Doctors for COVID Ethics by ophthalmologists who are talking about what the vaccines are doing to their patients and the trouble that they're seeing in the eyes before it really becomes, it starts almost immediately and builds up and the patients don't necessarily understand, you know, what's coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to sign up to go blind? They don't, you know, I mean, pardon the pun, but yeah, no one sees it coming because that's not what you bargain for when you go for a medical treatment.
Right. Well, there's no doubt you're watching. I mean, we're watching them clean out people who've used up their political capital, and getting rid of Walensky is a perfect example. And I think one of the reasons that's happening is, you know, you have more and more people who they or their families have been harmed and they're angry.
Yeah. Yep. And they should prepare to get angrier given the next story. You mentioned Aaron Seary. That's another guy at the front of battling for transparency with Pfizer, Moderna, and these guys. He's a lawyer. He's filed a FOIA suit. He's got another one here. FDA ordered to produce Moderna COVID-19 vaccine and Pfizer adolescent COVID-19 vaccine data at an average rate of 180,000 pages per month. Okay, and he says, you know, we had the first case, basically, where we battled the FDA and then we got the judge to make them produce documents at a rate of 55,000 pages per month, as opposed to what the FDA wanted, which was 75 years it was going to take them to do the production. Now we've got a second lawsuit. In the second lawsuit we got the same judge, okay? He just ordered the FDA to produce documents it relied on to license Moderna's COVID vaccine and Pfizer's COVID vaccine for kids at an average rate of at least $180,000 per month, okay? The second lawsuit—
Pages, 180,000 pages.
Yeah, pages per month. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
He's getting on the ball. But anyway, the federal judge says, in an amazing decision, says democracy dies behind closed doors and ordered them produced millions of pages in just 2 years. That's where the 180,000 is coming from. 180,000 pages per month because they've got millions of documents to produce. Again, great job by Aaron Seary.
You know, it's unbelievable. Can you imagine being the attorney tasked with trying to justify keeping everything under seal for 75 years?
Well, yeah, it's not what you might think. It's done electronically now. Right. You file stuff under seal on PACER.
Right.
Or in the courts, it ends up on PACER.
Right. Yeah. Don't you have to file a justification of why you think you should get everything under seal for 75 years?
Yeah, but you do that at the front end. You do that before there's the first documents turned over so that you don't have to go back and do it. Right.
Okay. I don't know.
Yeah. There's ways of handling this, trust me. Corporate attorneys are good at protecting the their client's secrets.
Yep.
Anyway, but good. But hey, high marks for Aaron Siri getting 180,000 pages per month.
Very
That's interesting. It's, you know, it's interesting that the judge has upped the number from 55. He tripled it to 180, basically.
Right. And what the companies hope is they bury you with so much paper, you won't find out what's going on. And that's another kudo to Naomi Wolf, who put together, I think, 4,000 doctors and lawyers to read everything. So
180,000 is a lot. That's a lot. I mean, I had to go through. One of the first cases I worked on was, it was 300,000 documents, probably, you know, let's just say 500,000 pages. That takes a while to get through.
Yep.
Yeah. It takes a long. Now, you're going to hit reams and reams of stuff that's like computer printouts and stuff. And you can, you know, one day you hit a trove of 10,000, you just toss it aside. But
right,
you're going to hit a lot of emails too. And then that slows you down.
Yep. Okay. I remember.
You're right. You've been in litigation. Remember. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, let's wrap it up in Farmageddon. The story from Zero Hedge. Top U.S., quote, nonprofit, end quote, hospitals and CEOs racked up huge pandemic profits. Look at these numbers. The 20 largest nonprofit hospitals in the country continued making massive profits while their cumulative and net assets soared from $324.3 billion in 2021. Soared to $325 billion from $200 billion just 3 years earlier. Hospital executives racked up Wall Street-sized compensation packages, which frequently exceeded $10 million per year. For example, the CEO at Ascension Healthcare in St. Louis made $13 million in 2021, with a three-year pay exceeding $22 million. And what do you get for all this? Look at this. American life expectancy during this period sharply declined by 2.5 years from 2019 through 2022. And at the same time, the average family is now paying $22,500 in health insurance premiums. So in other words, these guys are being paid to bleed you financially and to bleed the life out of you biologically. And for that, they're getting paid millions and millions of dollars.
So I'm in Switzerland. Switzerland has almost half the cost per capita for healthcare, and the population is significantly healthier than the United States. Yep. The United States healthcare costs are just, you know, they are beyond the pale. And how this is going to work out over the next 10 years, I can't imagine.
I don't either. Right. How are you going to pay for that? No, that's a $22,500 per year per family for premiums.
So when Obamacare started, I went into the website just to check what would apply to me. At the time, I had zero salary. So my income was zero. Yeah. And they wanted $850 a month.
Right. Yeah.
That was the year that more people signed up for a one-way trip to Mars than for Obamacare.
That's good. That's good. Okay, let's turn to pushback. And this first story, it's another Substack, so I can't highlight it. But basically, the idea here is elites manufacture fake hate crisis as pretext for mass spying, blacklists, and censorship. This is the conclusion, that the hate speech is really all about mass spying, blacklists, and censorship. How does this guy get to that? Well, it's basically this way. He says, if you look at convictions in courts for hate crimes, they're flat. Very flat. 2012, 107 convictions in California. 2021, 109. Very flat. Right. At the same time, however, if you look at stories on race and racism and hate crimes and everything else, they go through the roof. You know, multiples and multiples higher. And he's saying that's all about control and spying and everything else, but the post is for paid subscribers. But I thought that was interesting. Just the fact that the convictions on hate crimes are flat and the coverage is
through. But they're setting up a hotline to get you to call.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So they're trying to get people to accuse each other of hate crimes, and they're trying to generate, you know, it's another divide and conquer operation.
Yeah, they're trying to get people to rat each other out.
Right.
And speculate as to, and to do that, they're saying, well, it's a hate crime, so you're free to speculate on what the other person's motive is.
Right.
So go ahead and call us and let us know what you think.
Right. So if you get mad at your neighbor about them mowing the lawn, you know, on too early on a Saturday morning, you call into the hotline.
Yep. Yep. Okay, let's keep it going and push back. And I've said this before, I think one of the most effective forms of pushback is humor.
Uh-huh.
And here's the Babylon. Here's the Babylon Bee with a funny take
on this. This is pretty funny.
Since we've taken a whack at Republicans today, time for Democrats to take it on the chin. Poll: most Democrats in favor of welcoming immigrants into someone else's neighborhood. Okay, we found that 92% of liberal Americans are strongly in favor of as many immigrants as possible moving into the country, as long as they never have to see them or deal with them in person, said the study's lead researcher, Dr. Henry Bollockson.
So, you know, Governor Abbott has shipped 2 busloads of immigrants up to Kamala Harris's house.
Yeah, more power to him. Way to go.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious.
I do, too.
And I know that Democrats, they can't stand that. It's like shooting dirty pool. So immature to do that. Playing with people's lives. You're the one playing with our lives, you know?
Well, if you look at how many of the people coming up to the border have been financed by charities being funded by, you know, whether it's corporations or the governments, this is a, you know, this is a big money game.
Yeah. It's a giant money game. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's cut to the last story in pushback. And this is really, we've talked about this before. I wonder if you can add a little bit to this. Support Dr. Sukrit Bhakti, okay? And they say at the end here, hey, you know, thanks for reading this. Please share the information. I clicked the links to see, are they looking for contributions? And the only thing I could find is an email to Taylor Hudak if you want more information. But maybe you could explain.
Yeah, so Dr. Bhakti has provided information on how to contribute. And so if you want to make a donation, just send an email to Taylor. It's up on the website, and she'll send you the information.
Okay.
So it's different instructions for people in different, you know, it's different than in Europe than it is in the United States. So you get different instructions. But and he doesn't want it posted sort of publicly. So we're going to send it out to people who are willing to donate. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing to do. We see doctors and scientists all around the world being subject to these contrived enforcements. So Dr. Bhakti talked about how terrible the lockdowns were and the vaccine mandates in Israel, and now he's being accused of inciting hatred and anti-Semitism. You know, the whole thing is just ridiculous. There's no law.
If you have ever listened to him speak for as much as 15 seconds,
right,
you know, is patently ridiculous. This guy...
Right.
Is his heart's in the right place, and
cares. Well, the interviews are always calls for peace. Do you know what I mean? It's just anyway, so the whole thing is, but there it's happening to doctors and scientists all around the world. And Taylor has written a piece about what you can do. One thing you can do is share this information. The more people who know this is going on, the more people who pray for Dr. Bhakti, the better. If you want to donate, you're more than welcome. Just contact Taylor, and she'll send you the information. But the other thing you can do is everywhere around each one of us, there are doctors and scientists who are being targeted with the same kind of contrived enforcements in your town, in your county, all around you. Find them and support them and help them, because every one of them we help and everyone we help push back, you know, it makes it harder for them to do it. And these doctors and scientists have saved millions of lives. Dr. Bhakti, you know, I think we showed the film where Dr. Bhakti was just attending in Kiel, Germany, where he and his wife live. They were attending Daniel Gonzer's lecture, and the crowd saw them and just leaped up and gave them a standing applause. It was incredible.
I think
he saved that many lives. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it. I don't think we had the video, but anyway.
Anyway, all the information is up at Doctors for COVID Ethics. We have a commentary at Solari, and if you just do a search for his name, you'll pick it up, and it'll take you to the website, and there all the information is there. The hearing is scheduled for May 23rd, so for heaven's sakes, put him in your prayers.
Right. So we'll turn back. Well, we won't be back for another 2 weeks, so hopefully we'll have good news on how that went
right
when we reconvene in a fortnight.
Right.
Yeah. For now, it is on to charts. Are you ready?
Yep.
For some private
Four biggest
charts?
Private equity firms.
Here we go.
So I wanted to take a look from two events. One was FASB 56. So FASB 56 suddenly says, okay, games and get easier.
That's why that date is there.
Yeah, October 2018.
Right.
So we're watching several firms. So we're seeing Blackstone, which I believe is the high blue. I can't see it.
That's BX. Yep.
Yeah. And then we have Carlyle, we have TPG, and we have KKR. So you've got the four largest private equity firms, and then S&P. TPG is down at the bottom. And as you can see, they're sort of rising after FASB 56. And then when the going direct reset gets voted on, then with the pandemic, they explode.
Yeah,
and
so
let's a bubble compared to the S&P.
So this graph here is from FASB 56, and then you can see Blackstone and KKR are the lead horses in that race, okay?
Right.
The next one, though, like you say, is going direct reset in August of 2019, and it's the same two horses in front. KKR and BX have swapped positions.
Right.
The S&P is still in the middle, and the same two laggards.
Well, but here's the thing. These guys had a great time on the reset in the pandemic. They made a fortune.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, KKR and Blackstone both, or Blackstone both, they're up 96% and 81%.
Right.
Right.
And that's after coming down from that high.
Right.
So at the peak, they were really flying.
They were really going gangbusters. What were they? Let me go back to the chart. Yeah. Since FASB 56, they were up 115% and 77%, those top two.
Right.
But then here, they come back down, continuing to trend down. And then the third chart here we got is year to date.
So here's what happens. You get these plays, you know, so you get an operation like the pandemic or an operation like the Ukraine war, and you get a rush, you know, you get that bubble up. But then it's over, and it's a little bit like an addict. You need your next play. You need your next shot. So year to date, what we realize is they're all, you know, they're now starting to underperform.
Yeah, right. They're also rants, basically.
Right.
Not
so
even.
If you look at the S&P or if you look at the, you know, they're underperforming. I forget if it's this chart or the next where I show how they're doing against gold and the treasuries.
Yeah, let's take a look.
Right.
That's the safety trade. Here you go.
Yeah, so the safety trade. So any investor worth his salt is saying, well, why take risk with these guys? I can make more in treasuries. I can make more in gold. I can make more. I put in the ticker for Union Pacific, so a railroad with a nice dividend. You know, the Union Pacific is going to be here in 10 or 20 years is what we all assume. So I called it a value trade. But if you look at the safety of a bread and butter stock versus a treasury bond versus the S&P, suddenly you're looking better than why take the risk of a private equity? So if you're the private equity guys, you're like, okay, what's the next op, right?
Yeah.
That's the danger. And of course, my fear is, you know, it's rolling up the banks in the heartland. And that's why I was so adamant. You can't let the FDIC do this. You cannot create a set of conditions that make it financially attractive for vulture capitalists to destroy the banking industry.
Yeah, I think we're watching. To me, there is the perp here is the Fed.
Right.
The FDIC is an appendage in this operation.
Right. And I would say the perp is the Fed and the New York Fed. I would target New York Fed.
When I say the Fed, I mean the New York Fed. I mean the one that does QE, and I mean the one that has trading desks. The rest of them don't. I mean the permanent member of the FOMC and the only permanent member of the FOMC.
Right.
That's the New York Fed. Yeah.
Right.
Fair enough. Okay. Okay. Let's keep it going with charts. After the safety trade, this leading cable news networks in the United States in February 2023 by number of primetime viewers. And look at these numbers. Right.
So you know what these numbers say? These numbers say everybody knows the Durham report is true.
Yeah,
The market is walking away.
Okay, so Fox is the leader, and it's got 2.3 million people. MSNBC, these are terrible numbers, okay?
Right.
These are terrible numbers. These are primetime numbers.
The reason CNN did a town hall with Trump is it was the only way they could get any viewers.
Yeah.
That's how bad it is. Right.
But even more shocking is the viewers 25 to 34. Or 25, I'm sorry, 25 to 54. Look at this. 119,000 on MSNBC.
Right.
Okay. In primetime. Primetime. You've got 100. I have more people coming to my YouTube channel than that. That's ridiculous.
Well, but I know we keep coming back to Kennedy, but Kennedy for years has been creating workarounds because he's been so censored. So, you know, he's on Russell Brand. He's on Mike Adams. He's on all these workarounds. But now the workarounds have significantly more market share than the legacy media.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Anyway. Now, go back and look at that chart one more time. The numbers for Fox were before Tucker Carlson left. So when Tucker Carlson launches whatever he's going to do on Twitter, what do you think those numbers are going to look like?
Yeah, that's not going to be a pretty picture.
Nope.
That's not going to be good.
Man. That's going to be great. It's going to be better than good. It's going to be fantastic.
They're going to have to recalibrate that chart and make it look normal again anyway.
Right. Right.
Speaking of Kennedy, I watched a little bit of him yesterday in the Senate Banking Committee. Did you see any of that?
Uh-uh.
Yeah, so they're yesterday, the Senate Banking Committee has got the head of the Becker, the head of Silicon Valley Bank, and one of the other banks in there in the hot seat. And Kennedy's just...
Now, we're talking about the Senator Kennedy now.
Yeah, the Senator Kennedy, sorry. Yeah, you triggered me. I was like, oh, yes, Kennedy, that's right.
Yeah.
I wish we had a video of it. It was great. He was busting this guy's chops for like, so you're ignoring all these interest rates problems, banking 101. You can't figure that out. But yet you've got time for 300 seminars in your company about what pronoun to use. He was laying it on thick. It was pretty
good.
I love that man. Okay, let's turn to Solari in-house with Hero, previous wrap-ups and connections. Here we go. Quarterly wrap-up.
So we get tremendous numbers of questions. How do I find a financial planner? How do I find an asset manager? How do I find a CPA? How do I find this financial professional, that financial pressure? So I got Tim Caban, who is a wonderful financial planner in Pennsylvania, to sit down with me when I was in Pennsylvania and go through in great detail sort of how you find these people, how you vet them, how you work with them. So it's everything you wanted to know about how to identify and find the financial professional for you. And I can't tell you how many of these questions we get. So I finally asked him to do it, and he did a great job. So for those of you who are not happy with the financial professionals in your life and you want a successful financial professional relationship, here's how to do it.
Fantastic.
It's good.
That's great. A lot of misinformation going on in those quarters right now, but let's keep it going. Yeah. Here we go.
So the legal fellows at Children's Health Defense asked us if we would do a briefing on the financial system and why the financial system was driving to push for this kind of crazy centralized control and how healthcare is being used to sort of, you know, make the central banks, you know, the world safe for the central bankers. Anyway, so we put together it's basically 45 minutes, a brief history of the financial system, the global financial system with a, you know, sort of U.S.-centric from World War II on. And with it, we did a PowerPoint with a complete link collection and linking to many of the works you've done on the Going Direct Reset or CBDC. And for those of you who don't understand how we got to where we are, it really does, in a relatively short period of time, walk you through the whole process and then give you a wealth of links to deep dive any aspect of that that you want. So it turned out, I think, for many of the people who are watching it to be far more useful in helping you understand how we got to the crazy place where we are.
If you're able to do that in 45 minutes, you know, my hat's off to you. That's
well, you know, it's funny. Carolyn didn't believe I could do it. She didn't believe I could do it, but we did it.
Yeah,
we
did it. That's pretty tight. Okay, yeah. I must say. Okay, next up is Hero of the Week.
Andrew Brigden is the MP who's gotten thrown out of the, I guess it was the Conservative Party. He's now part of a new party. He's the only one in Parliament from that new party. And now he says he's going to sue Matt Hancock, which I would love to see. And I just got a briefing this morning from the CHD Europe people on what he's planning on suing on, which is, sounds like he's going to go after him on the whole shebang. Now, I can't think of anybody who deserves to, you know, be put in the gallows more than Matt Hancock. So I can't wait.
No, you'd have to come to the U.S. to find that person. Sorry.
Right.
Okay. New lectures from Thomas Meyer.
Yeah, so while I'm here in Switzerland, my partner Robert Duper is here. Let me just pull this to do the last three lectures that we're doing for this series. We started 2 years ago a series of that's sort of an overview of all the Steiner work. And we're about to publish, we've just published two in the last 2 months. And we're going to publish the one on agriculture sometime in the next 2 weeks. And then we'll come back from Switzerland with the last three lectures. So check out the Spiritual Science website. It's spiritualscience.solari, and you can link from the homepage. But if you're interested in Steiner and Anthroposophy, it's a great series. And, you know, part of the challenge of reading Steiner is, you know, there's so much material. And this is designed within 10 lectures to give you an overview of everything. And it's terrific.
But, you know, that's you need that when you've got somebody that prolific. You really do.
Steiner was frighteningly prolific.
Yeah.
I really delayed reading Steiner because it was just so overwhelming. And then I had a subscriber when I was driving all over the country who said she'd read it to me while I was driving around. So I literally read 14 books of Steiner, including agriculture, you know, in the car, listening, driving down the highway.
Yeah, that's a big task because, you know, these people, they change their minds. Like, well, that wasn't as... How many times did Keynes change his mind? You know, Alfred Mann,
right.
All the time. Like, well, when are you reading him? 30 or 40? It's a different guy. The opposite. Anyway, did you want to say something about Matt Hale and collision insurance?
Yeah, so we don't have it up yet. We'll have it up by the time we record this. Matt Hale just wrote, you know, he deals a lot with sort of practical family issues on car insurance and sort of auto issues. And he's written something on collision insurance, which we'll post for subscribers this week. And you definitely, you know, if you've got a car and you drive and you get car insurance, you want to read it. I've found car insurance paying a lot of attention to what your car insurance is, what you're paying for, and making sure you're getting the real thing is that's worth paying attention to.
Yeah.
And I just want to hold it up because we've got it from the printers. The Building Wealth Wrap-Up is now out. We just bought a box to Switzerland. So it's being mailed in Europe at the end of this week, and then it'll mail in the U.S. towards the end of the month, and thousands going out all over the world. So Building Wealth. Now, it's interesting. The Building Wealth curriculum, if we put it in hard copy, it would be like the Encyclopedia Britannica. So a lot of that is up on the website. And so this is an overview and introduction to how to use the curriculum on the website. We can't. I assure you, you wouldn't want the whole thing in hard copy. Anyway, but check out the website at buildingwealth.solari.com. Make sure you're logged into Solari first. So it's a fabulous collection, and it's a way for, especially for people new to Solari, it's a great way to access all the content in a way that is, you know, it's like a buffet, but it's organized because it's action-oriented to helping you live your free and inspired life.
That's great.
So, yeah.
Yeah, super. Yeah. Okay, well, that's it for Money and Markets this week. And now we come to the scariest time of any month, which is with 2 weeks of stories accumulating.
Well, here's the thing. This whole month has been a barn burner.
Yeah, I know.
It's just been a barn burner, and the stories take my breath away, especially what's going on with the banks. So
I know. And then on the heels of that, you get the Durham report comes out. It's amazing.
Well, here's the thing. If you're The American people are really grappling with the fact that the government and the media ran a 4-year hoax on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Lying through their teeth 24/7 for 4 years.
Right. But that means when you sit down and you look at your money, whether it's the taxes you pay or what's happening with your pension fund or where you're going to put your retirement savings, who can you trust?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I tell people. Don't stop worrying about returns. Okay. You got to stop. You got to get over that game.
Right.
It shifted. Worry about access. Can you get to it?
Right. Can you get to it? And do the people managing it have integrity? You know, and I hate to say it, it starts with who's your farmer, who's your fisherman, because you do not want to eat Gates's edible peels.
Right? No, who's your sheriff? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, well, John, have a great week off, and I will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Okay, Catherine. Have a good
ladies, one. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salier Report. And remember, live from Switzerland, online at UK Column and CHD TV this Friday. Who do you think you are? Bye, John.
See ya.